The Asian Classics Institute presents The Art of Reasoning with Geshe Michael Roach, recorded live in New York City in March of 1998.
This is the beginning of Class 1.
Something like class number 13, okay, course number 13. When we started the courses, Anitama and I went out and we bought 6 chairs at IKEA in New Jersey and brought it back in a Honda, and I figured if we could make 6 good translators, it would be a big achievement, you know. So I'm happy to see that there are many people here. Tonight we're going to study Buddhist logic. We're going to start Buddhist logic. I waited 13 courses to start Buddhist logic because I was afraid everyone would run away after the first class. So I figured my first job is to sell you on the idea of studying Buddhist logic. And then maybe you won't run away till like the third class or something. So I'll tell you the story about Geltabje. Geltabje was the main disciple of Jetsun Kapa. Jetsun Kapa is really the beginning of our lineage, and he was the teacher of the first Dalai Lama. His dates are 1357 to 1419, okay? Geltabje, the word Geltab means regent, meaning he took over the sho after Jetsun Kapa passed away. He was assigned by Jetsun Kapa. He was appointed as Jetsun Kapa's replacement. Perhaps you don't know the story of their first meeting. Geltabje at the time was the most famous logician in Tibet. And in fact, in the winter, we have intermonastic competitions, and we study from his book on logic. It's about 400 pages long. It takes 15 years to get through the first 2 chapters in the winter debates. So he was an incredible logician. So he heard that this guy from East Tibet was making sort of a big smash in central Tibet, that he had come from the east, and that people were starting to come to his classes a lot. So he was curious, and he thought he would go and blow this guy away in some debate. So he heard that Jetsun Kapa was teaching outside of Lhasa somewhere, and he decided he would show up and disrupt the class. So he put on his big debater's costume and his big pundit's hat, you know, and he started off, and he got lost on the way. And he was on the path, and the lecture was already starting, you know. And he finally is wandering to this pasture, and he meets this young lady who is tending the cows, you know, like a cow herder. And she's covered with dirt, and she's all disheveled, and her hair is all mess. And he says, do you know where Big Nose is teaching tonight? Because Jensen Kapa had a big nose, okay? His enemies called him Big Nose from the East. And she said, do you know where Big Nose is teaching tonight? And she says, what do you mean Big Nose? And he says, you know, that guy, Tsongkhapa, came in from the East recently. You know, a lot of people coming to his classes now. And she said, no, I don't know. But aren't you Gyaltab Jay, the famous logician, you know? And he says, yes, I am, you know. And she says, oh, I've always wanted to meet a great logician, you know. I have this burning question in my mind, and I always wanted to meet a great logician, you know. And he says, don't worry, I can answer any question about Buddhist logic. So she points to a cow who's making a pecan pie, okay? And says, I have this question, you know, when they raise their tail and the poop comes out, it's kind of going up, but then when they're done, it falls down. And I was wondering which is the top and which is the bottom of the cow pie, you know? Because going out, it's one way, and then going, when it falls down, it's the opposite, you know? And then Gyaltab Jay was like stumped, you know, and he suffered. And it took like 10 minutes, you know, and then he couldn't get it. He couldn't figure it out. So he turned around and looked at her, and suddenly there's this goddess blazing with golden light, you know? And she has this incense stick between her hands, you know? She says, I don't know what you mean about Big Nose from the East, but if you mean the incomparable, glorious, incredible Jetson Kapa, master of all the world, you know, Buddhism, he's teaching over there, you know. And then there's this beautiful story of what happened. So you never know who's who, okay? That's one of the reasons to study logic, and we're going to get into that. So I thought I'd tell you what we're going to study, and then show you how it fits into the master plan of what you're doing over the long run, 5 years, okay? So I think we'll do first the syllabus, okay? This is what you're going to be studying. Class one, we're going to go over the class policies, finish that. I'm going to give you an overview of the course, which is what I'm doing now. And then each class will be divided into three parts. First, you'll get content. Okay, content means something to debate about. Okay, when we teach logic, which kids in the monastery start about 12 years old, it's the first thing you ever study in a Buddhist monastery. We'll do the content of logic for about 10 different classes about what are you studying to debate about, and these are great subjects from the ancient logic books that were written about 1,300 years ago. And I'll go into that, where it comes from. Then the second part of each class will be the format of logic. You know, like, how do you make a good reason? What's a bad reason? You know, how do you know a reason is a good reason? And things like that, okay? The third part of each class will be, I'll teach you a little bit about Buddhist debating, okay? I don't know if you've ever seen it in a Buddhist monastery, but it's a lot of fun. And we'll be doing a little bit of Buddhist debating, okay? So that's never been taught to a wide public audience in the United States. So I thought it'd be fun for you guys to do it. It's a very, very powerful tool for learning Buddhism. In the monastery, we debate every day, except Tuesday, which we're off because it's market day. Every other day, we debate twice a day. The evening debates start at 6 o'clock. You might get out at 11. You might get out at 3 in the morning. But you take the lesson that you learned that day, and you get in a group with like 10 or 20 of your fellow students, and you rip it apart by screaming at each other, okay? And it's a lot of fun, if you've ever seen it in a Buddhist monastery. But I'll teach you a little bit about it. This custom has existed for 2,500 years, and it'd be really good if we could do it in this country, okay? So we'll talk a little bit about that. So every class will be three parts. First part is something to debate about, some part of Buddhist philosophy, okay? Second part of the class will be the format of logic, how to make a good reason and what's a false reason. And then thirdly, the forms of debating, how do you debate? Okay, so each class will be like that. Section two, class number two, the topic will be, there's a beautiful section in the logic books that outlines the all of existence. How do you classify all existing things? And it's very useful for Buddhists, okay? You should know. And that'll be the subject matter. The logic, formal logic subject we'll start to get into how do you make a good reason, how do you make a logical statement, okay? And then the debate thing for that night will be how do you stand, how do you bang your foot, how do you use a rosary? You got to have a rosary when you debate, okay? You might have to hit your opponent with it. You never know, okay? And how to formulate a logical statement on the debate ground in the midst of fire, okay? Class three, there's a special subject called quality and characteristic, chichedat. If you want to see emptiness directly, this is the most powerful thing you can study. It's about how do you make mental images and how do you confuse them with the objects. And it's a very, very powerful subject, and we'll do that for the third class. Formal logic will be the idea of similar cases and dissimilar cases. Debating will be how to give your answers. Debating is like a flowchart. It's really cool. The guy that's attacking says, I think the Buddha meant this when he said that. And all you're allowed to do when you respond is yes, no, yes, no, not necessarily. You know. So when you see a debate, you'll see one guy standing up screaming like, you know, his lungs off, and then the other guy's just sitting there going, yeah, no. Yeah, no. You know, and it's really a beautiful exercise because it's like a computer program. It's like on-off switch. The guy who's answering can only say yes or no, or not necessarily, or some. You know, he has like four answers he can give. Sooner or later, if you frame the questions correctly, you must reach truth. Okay? It's a very interesting process, and this is the point of debating. If you frame the questions properly, if the questioning goes in a good line, by the end of the night, you must reach the truth of something just by answering yes or no. You see? It's like a flow chart. If no, go this way. If yes, go this way. And you keep throwing questions at the guy, and sooner or later, you reach the truth of anything. And you can pick any subject that you're confused about, anything you don't understand very clearly, just by answering yes or no. If the debater is a good debater, by the end of the night, you must reach the truth. You see, and that's the point of Buddhist debate. It's not who went. You know, Americans are always asking me. I had 15 people went with me when I did my Geshe exam. And I'd come home all sweaty, and they'd say, well, who won, you know? And I'd say, nobody, everybody wins, you know? It's just yes, no, yes, no, and then you reach the truth, and everybody's happy, and they go home, you know? And that's the point. It's not a competition. That's a Western idea, I think. In the monastery, you're just trying to reach the truth. And if the questions are good, you must reach the truth. And it's really nice. It's really exciting. So you go into the debate ground with all your unanswered questions, and you throw them out in front of all your classmates, and then sooner or later you get the truth out. And it's really nice. It works. And you can do that with anything you're not sure about in Buddhism. That's the whole point. Class four will be cause and effect. There's a beautiful essay on cause and effect in the logic scriptures. For the formal logic subject, we'll start to talk about a syllogism, what are the different parts of a syllogism. And then for debating, there's a really nice thing called a tangyur, which is somebody says emptiness is just this black space that you put your mind on. So you say, well, I guess you can perceive emptiness by closing your eyes or something, right? And that's called a tangyur. In Sanskrit, it's called a prasangika. And it's a method of seeing emptiness, you see? It has a special ability to help you see emptiness. And the highest school of Madhyamika, the school of Nagarjuna, the school of Jetsukapa, the school of the Dalai Lama, is that. So you're going to learn how to do that. You're going to learn how to make what's basically a sarcastic statement, okay? Oh, yeah, so I guess if you close your eyes, you see emptiness, right? Okay, yimbatao, like that, okay? That's called a tengyur. Class 5. We'll talk about mind and their objects, okay? Subject minds and their objects of the mind. There's a lot of people who teach emptiness wrong. They say when you see emptiness, the mind who's seeing emptiness and the emptiness that it sees, they somehow melt into each other and blah, blah, blah. And if you study this basic subject from the logic text, you won't think that anymore, okay? So that's important for your study of emptiness. For the logic, we're going to study the different kinds of good reasons. There are three types. We're going to study the first one. And then for the debating, we'll learn how to answer a sarcastic question. You know, somebody says, oh, you think you can close your eyes and see emptiness? And then you have to learn the two kinds of answers that you give back. And you're going to learn that. Okay. By the way, the debate will be in English. All right. So you don't have to run away tonight. You can wait till next week. getting hot in here. I think better, they'll fall asleep. You know?
If you try it long enough, you find out it really works. You know? If you study Buddhism for a while, it starts to work.
Okay, class number 6. Yeah, negative and positive. There are different kinds of negative statements. There's different ways to define negative, positive, and it's very important. Why? There are schools of Buddhism, even in Tibet, which define emptiness in a very, very mistaken way. Emptiness is an absence of something. Emptiness means the self-existent thing which never existed anyway isn't there. Okay? And a lot of schools say other things which are completely wrong. And if you study this subject, you'll never fall into that trap. So it's very important. Each subject you study has importance for understanding the highest goals of Buddhism. Okay? Emptiness. Okay? Class number 7, the idea of contradiction and relationship. What does it mean for two things to be connected or related to each other? And what does it mean for two things to be the opposite of each other? Okay. And we'll study the logical statements which are used to prove the absence of something. And these are important because those are the logical statements used to prove emptiness itself. Okay, so you have to learn them. Okay, all the major reasonings used to prove emptiness have to do with proving that something's not there. Okay, and there are two different forms of that kind of logic, and you have to study them. Okay, the forms of debate on that night, don't miss class 7, debating tactics, how to distract your opponent, how to, taunt him properly, how to embarrass him in front of a large group of people. Stuff like that. Very good. Okay. We won't do anything like that. Number 8, definitions and how things are defined. Okay, they define how to define things. Okay, and that's a very wonderful thing to know. Okay, the logic part of that will be a special kind of proof for something that you can't see. Okay, how to prove something you can't see, the absence of something you can't see. Okay, we'll get into it. Class 9 is very important because it's called the concept of elimination in perception. What it means is that according to the logic schools, when you see something, it's because your mind is blocking out all the other things which are not it. Got it? When you perceive something, what's really happening is your mind is eliminating all other possibilities. And that's how you establish that something exists. Okay? Some Buddhist schools in Tibet believe that that is emptiness. It's called shenso. It's completely wrong. And you have to study all of these wrong ideas about emptiness. So one of the reasons to study this is to understand why shentong is a mistaken idea. Okay, and that's important. You can spend your whole life studying shentong. You'll never ever see emptiness. And you have to understand why that's wrong. And this is a presentation of why that's wrong. Okay. You got a lot of different stuff in the formal logic there. But basically, it's a summary of the formal logic up to that point. And then in the forms of debate, we're going to study what is it that the monks debate. There are about 12 or 13 different classes debating in the debate ground at any given time. And I thought you might like to know what each class is debating. Like, what are the sophomores debating? What are the juniors debating? What are the freshmen debating? Okay? And there will be, in a typical night, there will be 12 or 13 different groups of monks debating. So I thought it would be interesting for you to hear all the subjects they're debating. Class 10 is really interesting, I think. It's the concept of time. Time itself. You know, how do we perceive time? What is the nature of time? Does the future exist? Does the past exist? Does it assert any effects on us? How do you define time? Why do you perceive the passage of time? And that's going to be the subject of class number 10. We're going to discuss, very importantly, bad logic, okay, incorrect logic. There's a lot of things that are incorrect logic in Buddhist logic that are not incorrect in Western logic, okay? For example, in Buddhist logic, if you present an argument to somebody that they already accept, it's an incorrect reason, okay? It's an untrue reason, okay? If you try to argue something with somebody that they already accept, then the reason you give is false, according to Buddhism, all right? If you try to give a reason to someone which they can't already accept, but they just haven't tied it together, that's also untrue logic in Buddhism. And that's very relevant for Westerners, you know. Your job is going to be able to discuss Buddhism with other Americans, you know. And the rules of Buddhist logic require that they accept everything you say already, but they just haven't tied it together yet. So you're not allowed to present anything in an argument. Like, you're not allowed to talk about future lives in an argument with a person who doesn't already accept future lives, okay? As a proof, you see? You're only allowed to give or to talk about the things which they already accept, but they just didn't tie it together. And actually, that's how Western logic works also, but maybe you're not very sensitive to that fact, you see? If you go beyond what the other person already accepts, already you've blown the argument, you know? They may agree with you, but it won't be good logic. Probably they won't agree with you because you've mentioned something that they can't accept yet, okay? So the idea in Buddhist logic is to only use ideas which the other person already accepts, put them together in a new way, and help them see the truth of something that will help them, okay? And you will be studying that. I thought you'd like to see the traditional debate year. Like, there's a whole rhythm of the debate in the monastery, how it goes throughout the year. And so we'll talk about that. All these subjects have never been written down. And this is a result of a lot of research done over like 15 years in the monastery. You know, there's this vague schedule, and then if you study it for a year or two, you figure out there's a logic to it. And it's kind of beautiful. So we're going to be writing all that down for the first time. And you'll see an example tonight of that. Okay, that's the general design of the course. I wanted to let you see where this course stands in the whole 5-year program, which has become, I think, a 7-year program or something like that. Okay. I'm not going to... I mean, I have a transparency, but forget it. Okay. I wanted to place this course into the context of the courses you've had so far and the courses you're going to have. And I wanted to give you an idea of what's going to be happening in this class for the next 5 years, okay? Because I think some of you know I'm going on a 3-year retreat, and I wanted to clarify that, and I wanted to talk a little bit about it, okay? This is the plan for the next 5 years. You'll get a copy of this. I don't know. You have it. Okay. This class is the first thing, February, March, 98. These dates are approximate, okay? Give or take a month, all right? But I thought it would help you plan your vacations and stuff like that. We'll do this Art of Reasoning. In the Friday night course, which already started, we are studying the first great Buddhist book to be introduced into Tibet. It's the first Lam Rim text, and that's by somebody named Atisha. And we're studying a commentary by a great scholar from Saramay Monastery, which we located in Russia only about a month ago. And they typed it in and shipped it over here a week ago. And you'll be getting the installments of the translation. But this book has been missing for since 1959. It was written 300 years ago. It's a beautiful commentary to the first important book ever written for Tibetans to study Tibetan Buddhism. So I think it's kind of auspicious that as American Buddhism begins, we have this book to start from. Okay. April 98, I encourage everyone to go take retreats, have some short retreats like what we did up in Connecticut, which was really great. May to June 98, we'll be studying Lojong. Lojong is a special kind of Buddhist book. They're usually very short. They were written about 1,000 years ago. And they are dealing with everyday problems of life. You know, how to use Buddhism in your office. How to use Buddhism with your husband or your wife or your kids. You know, how to apply it to your everyday life. And they're very, very sweet. They're very short, very profound. We've never studied any of them in this class. We will pick about 3 or 4 Lojong texts, and you'll be studying those in the next course. That'll be course number 14. July, August, 98. Encourage everyone to take all of July and go on retreat, 1 month retreat if you can. If Rinpoche has finished teaching by then, which I think he will be. Okay. And then we'll be doing a 10-day meditation retreat at Godstall. Rinpoche threw me a loop. Yeah, I was leaving in 4 days. He said, anybody in New York who wants to know how to do a retreat, ask Michael. And, you know, we had a meeting the last night I was here, and I couldn't do much. So I felt bad, and I thought, is Mark Minervini around tonight? Where is he? Did you do your thing? I don't know. Okay, sorry. Like, I ran out of town, and people were left, didn't know how to do their retreats. So I thought once a year we'll do a 10-day retreat before Rinpoche's August teaching. And it'll also put your mind in the mood to go get Rinpoche's very holy teachings. I think it would be a good combination. So, and then it'll give me 10 days instead of 2 hours to show you how to do a proper retreat. Okay, so we'll do that in August. September 98, I've been teaching at a couple of centers in California, usually a 10-day course, and they're really, really nice. I mean, the people out there have been studying like 20 years, and they're very ripe, and we usually have a really good time. So I'll continue to do that in early September. Probably go to Australia for a tour. There's about, I don't know, 20 major centers in Australia. They're way ahead of us. They have 16 geshes teaching in the Lama Yeshe's organization in Australia. We have 2 in the whole United States. They're really doing well. So they asked, they'd like a Western presentation of the same material that they're getting. So they've asked us to come there. Then I'll go to Sarah. October, November, 98, we'll start course 15. Course 15 will be a subject called Circle. We study a book by Maitreya called Ornament of Realizations in the monastery for 12 years. It's the first subject you study after logic. Okay, it's the perfection of wisdom. Somewhere in the middle, you do a special course called Supplementary Perfection of Wisdom Topics. For example, the whole idea of dependent origination, the 12 links of dependent origination, is taught by Maitreya in one verse, 4 lines. Okay, it takes about 6 months to learn it. So they've written separate books to clarify the meaning of that Wheel of Life picture. Okay, then there's a subject called Alaya Vijnana, or Foundation Consciousness, the mind-only school's idea about Buddhism. Then there's a subject called Samsuk, which is the study of deep meditational states. There's a subject called Trange, which is very important. How do you know when the Buddha was speaking figuratively, and how do you know when he was speaking literally? In other words, when do you adjust Buddha's scripture? Because the Buddha was just sort of putting it on for effect, you see? The Buddha said, for example, kill your father and kill your mother. What he meant was, don't be afraid to leave your family and go study Buddhism if it's necessary, okay? But you can't take it on face value, right? Or you'll get in big trouble. And that's the art of interpreting the Buddha. It's a very, very serious subject. For example, the Buddha taught 4 different presentations, 5 of emptiness. 4 of them are wrong, okay? So how do you know when he was just trying to help people who didn't have the capacity to hear the higher teaching, okay? This is a very delicate subject for us, okay? When was he speaking the truth, and when was he just speaking figuratively, okay? Those subjects are all called circle. We located those books. They were missing. They were burned by the Chinese. It was the first book we ever put into the computer was the circle series, and paid for by Losen Gyatso, who's down in Howell. And we recovered all those books from other countries. So I think it's very auspicious if we study those. Those are very important subjects to study. On to the next page. December to January 99, everybody should go on retreat. about a month-long retreat. Then in 1999, we'll spend the whole year reviewing all 15 courses. Okay, so there'll be three courses. The first course will review the first five classes. And if you don't know who Rusty and Pancho are, you weren't at the first five classes. Those are the two dogs that used to bark in the back, okay, if you've ever heard the tapes. Anyway, it's a good chance to hear the content of the first five courses. In the second course of 1999, we'll review the second five courses, 6 through 10. And then in the third course, we'll review the last three courses. If you hope to get a certificate from this place, which I call a baby Geshe certification, okay, you have to finish those three review classes. And you're welcome to come to them even if you haven't done the first five courses, for example. You see? So if you hope to get a certificate from this place, which means you've finished all 15 courses, and on top of that, you finished the three review courses, okay? That's what it takes to be a baby Geshe here. 18 little courses of 6 weeks each. In the monastery, it's 18 years, so you didn't do so bad, okay? You have to have gone to those three courses, okay? You can either do them in 1999 or you can wait till 2010 or whatever it is, okay? But that's what will happen in 1999. I think it's a good opportunity for everyone to hear roughly the contents of all the courses. By the way, by the end of 98, you will have finished all the content that Geshe's ever learned, okay, frankly. It's definitely all they remember at 3 years out of the monastery, okay? We've memorized hundreds of pages of text, and if you don't practice them every day, which nobody does after you get your Geshe, because the word in Tibetan for doing your Geshe exam is Geshe Thang. Geshe. Thang. Geshe Thang. Thang also means to throw away. So they say, Geshe Thang. Oh, I threw out my books, I'm done now. It's like graduating from high school or something, you know. Not really, but anyway, it's a joke in the monastery. You will have covered the whole content of a Geshe's course, roughly. Okay, not as deeply as they do, but you will have heard everything. So 1999 is to do a review, okay? And everyone's welcome to come to that. And I think it's really good for the newer students because you can hear everything that's been taught here in the last 6 years in a rough way, in a fast food way, okay? The Friday night classes at that point will be centering around a special book that presents discussions, you know, imaginary discussions between the great Buddhist masters of history and a Westerner. Okay, April 99, go on retreat again. July, August, the same thing. If you want to learn how to do a retreat, you come for 10 days up to Godstow. September 99, the same schedule for California. And the people in Australia have asked us to go to the Far East and do a shtick there, okay? October, November 99, the third part of the review, and that's the last course of the Baby Geshe shtick, okay? It was like 7 years or something, all right? And by that time, you're a genius, all right? Then, in December 99, January 2000, okay, I will meet individually with students who want to help them design what they're going to do during my three-year retreat. Okay, so that means there'll be special courses going on here during those 3 years where you can make up what you didn't get. Okay, because if you finish everything, you're qualified to study some special stuff, which I will teach when I get back. Okay, so I'm bribing you. All right, it's blackmail? Right. If you want to get those special subjects when I get back, like in the monastery, you're not allowed to study the secret teachings of Buddhism. In Tibet, you didn't go to Tantra College unless you were a Geshe already. You know, the only people that got into Tantra College were Saramba Geshes. It's because you need the foundation to study it properly. So it's similar to that. And I'll sit with anyone who's interested, and during those 2 months, we'll talk over a one-on-one basis what courses you never had a chance to take, what courses you finished half of the homeworks and then dropped out, what courses you finished everything and never took the final, or we lost it at the Three Jewels or something. And or that was Rusty and Pancho, I think. You know, basically how to catch up to the rest of the people so that by the time I come out of three-year retreat, you'll be eligible to do that. If you don't go through that process, I refuse to teach you those subjects, okay? Because those are special things, and those will be done in very, very small groups, you know, if they're done, okay? If people are ready, okay? And that will be done in very, very small, serious groups, okay? Three-year retreat will probably be out west somewhere in Flagstaff, Arizona. And there are some changes I've made about it. If your board of directors in New York can arrange it, you're welcome to come out and participate in a partial way if that's all you can do. Okay? For example, if you have a month off or you can get... If you get laid off by some lucky chance from work, you can come out for a month or 2 months or 3 months, and you can participate in that general area, in that compound, and you can be part of that retreat in a general way. Okay, so that's a decision, but that's something that logistically. You guys will have to arrange here in the next... You have 24 months to get ready, okay? But we've made an offer on a property there to rent it for three years, and it has multiple houses on it, and people could come out and participate without having to stay for 3 years, which I imagine a few people couldn't do. So that's just one change. The other change is that twice a year... I will do 21 days of teaching, and then people can come and participate in the whole thing or part of the whole thing, and they can meditate there during that time and things like that. That'll be once around Christmas and once in the summer, like before Rinpoche's course or something like that, okay? I've done a lot of retreats, and I feel very strongly that if I did a three-year retreat, I could... achieve a lot of the goals that I talk about, and I really want to, and I think it's important to put your money where your mouth is, right? I really want to achieve those goals, and I really strongly feel that if I had a 3-year retreat, I could maybe you know, make some progress. So I think it's very important to do that, and I think it's... I don't think the classes have much meaning unless you're willing to do something like that in conjunction with the classes. And I think everybody here should eventually be doing at least month-long retreats as often as they can. I think you need that. I'm sure you need that to achieve the goals you want to achieve. So we'll talk more about that as time goes on. But it's very important for each person here to get in the frame of mind that eventually you could do a month-long retreat or, you know, a few of those every year. It's very, very important to get enlightened before you kick the bucket, okay? And you either go one way or the other. You either do some fantastic retreats and get enlightened, which is possible and you can do it, or you die. And who knows, you know, if you think it's hard to get time when you're alive, it's really hard to get time in the bardo and all that, you know? So, okay? And I'm not kidding, okay? Sooner or later, everyone... I'm trying to state in my actions that this is a career path that most people here should consider eventually. And it's kind of to push you into it, all right? So that's the schedule for the next 5 years, okay? There's another document in your notebook which kind of... I don't know, you have the overview? Yeah? Okay. It's a very beautiful summary of what this course has been, okay, of all 18 courses, and there's about 5 or 6 supplementary courses, like how to do a mandala and stuff like that. This is the outline of what a Geshe studies for 18 years, the thing that's called the overview. okay? And we're done. I mean, the concept is done. You'll be finished by the end of 98, and you have covered all the things that a Geshe covers, okay? And that'll be done. During the 3 years, there'll be courses called seminar courses, and they will go over again the contents of the earlier courses. Like, most people in this room didn't go to course number one on Lam Rim, okay? So one of the students who did take that course and who did well in it will lead a group of people. You'll come once a week. You'll have a discussion group. You'll listen to the tape at home. You'll do the homeworks and the quizzes, and you'll take a final exam and just like that. But it'll be what I call a seminar course, so that you can catch up and be ready by the end of the 3 years for the for special teachings, if you're ready for that. Okay. That's all the spiel about the grand plan. Okay. By the end of that, you are qualified as a Geshe, baby Geshe, and I think we'll do probably some short courses after that of how to teach, you know, which is a different thing, you know, like how to present Buddhism to normal American people. I mean, if there's any in here. I thought it'd be good for us to go over that. So we'll be doing that also. But then I would expect each of you to get out of town and go start a Dharma center somewhere. Jetsun Kapa took his dearest students and from Lhasa and told them to walk to eastern Tibet 1,000 miles away and don't come back till you started 108 monasteries. Like Nawan Dapa, for whom the Three Principal Paths was written. That was a letter written to this poor guy who got banished to East Tibet, and he couldn't come back till he'd finished 108 monasteries. And he did. I don't know if he ever came back, though. anyway, I'd like to see you guys start teaching after that. And then you'll be qualified to teach after that. And there's no reason why not, okay? Geshe Tsuga, good Geshe from that other place, Sarah J, I guess it is. He grabbed me, he called me in Boston, he says, "You get those Americans going, you know, you can't depend on Tibetans all the time, you know. Make a couple of Geshes, you know, start some monasteries, get some courses going, you know. You don't need us, you know, get your asses in gear, you know." And he screamed at me for an hour. It's really good. So I think we should do that, all right? There's no reason why not. Frankly, that's all they teach you in the monastery, okay? And there's precious few people who finish it. You know, out of a class of 60, maybe 3 or 4 people finish. In my class, 2 people have finished and maybe 1 more will finish, okay? And that's all you learn, okay? There's no reason why you shouldn't start teaching them and helping other people, okay? Okay, now we'll start the actual class, and I'll give you a break pretty soon. I know it's hot, and try to stay awake, okay? If you don't know the rules of this class, you don't have to learn Tibetan, okay? I just put it up for the people who want to learn Tibetan, all right? You can do all the answers in English on the homework, no problem, okay? But you should try to learn it, okay, if you can. The Buddhist logic tradition comes from this guy named Shakyamuni. Okay? It starts with the Buddha, 500 BC. He started logic. He was a very good logician. He was a master debater. The sutras are full of stories of him wiping out other schools with debate. And it was a popular thing in those times. It was not a joke. Okay? In ancient India, representatives of different religions would meet before the king in the court of the king, and they would debate it. They would slug it out in debate for 2 or 3 weeks, and then the king and his ministers would decide who had given the most convincing arguments, and the losing religion had to give up their religion and join the religion of the winner. So the stakes were very high, and we didn't always win, okay? I mean, the Buddhists lost sometimes, and then they would send in the heavy-duty guys, and they would recoup it, you know? But there were cases where, you know, Nalanda Monastery, where they sent a lightweight monk out, he lost. It looked like we had to switch over, and then they'd send Nagarjuna out, and he would win the day or something, you know. But it was very high stakes. And even up to the 800s and the 900s, the style of meditation followed in Tibet was decided by a debate of that nature. Kamala Shila from India, representing the Indians, debated Huashang, representing the Chinese, who said, oh, close your eyes and think about nothing. And it was a very serious debate, and it went on for quite some time, and luckily Kamala Shila won. And he wrote a huge book that's in the Tengyur, two volumes, about how to meditate, which is all the basis of Tibetan meditation is that. So even up to the beginning of Buddhism in Tibet, everything was decided by debating. Okay. In the monastery, you start debating at age, you start studying Buddhist logic at age 12. You learn how to write, you learn how to read, and by age 12 you are thrown into your first Buddhism class. It's how to debate, how to make a good reason, how to think straight. Okay, and you do that for 3 years with your house teacher. Your house teacher is like a big babysitter who has to teach all the kids. When it reaches a certain point, then they're allowed to go study with the great Geshe's and things like that. But for 3 years, you're stuck with your house teacher. Rinpoche has great stories about his house teacher and how he tortured him, mutually. And you study like that. Then at age 15, you're qualified to enter the debate ground. Okay, and you're allowed to enter the debates and start. But it's the very first thing you study in the monastery. The book we use to study Buddhist logic in the monastery is called Tsema Namdo. Okay, it was written by Lopan Chögyi Drakpa. Chögyi Drakpa's name in Sanskrit is Dharmakirti. I used to confuse him all the time with Chandrakirti, okay? Don't do that, all right? Chandrakirti is the great Madhyamika scholar. Dharmakirti is the big Buddhist logician, all right? He lived about, 650, I think. Yeah. His book at the time there were some very heavy debates going on about Buddhist logic. The big founder of Buddhist logic in India was Master Dignaga. He passed away before Dharmakirti was born. Some people say Dharmakirti started with him directly. We don't really know. Okay, but people started to attack Master Dignaga's presentation of logic, and so Dharmakirti came to the rescue. All right, and he named his. It's a defense of Master Dignaga's idea about Buddhist logic, and its name is Tsema Namdo. Okay, say it, Tsema.
Tsema.
Namdo.
Namdo.
Tsema.
Namdo.
Tsema means valid perception. It's like a correct perception, but there's a reason to say valid. I always make the distinction like this. I worked in this corporation for 16 years. Me and Pelma, we used to work on the JCPenney account. JCPenney would order like 2,000 rings with a quarter carat stone in it. I would have to decide if they were going to get a cheap stone with a black spot in it or a cheap stone with a yellow color. Sometimes I would make the wrong choice based on their request. You know, they would ask for that. They'd say, we want yellow color because the customer doesn't care. They just want something big and cheap. So we would go out and buy them. Sometimes we'd go out and buy the wrong thing according to the instructions we got. Okay. Then my boss would come in and scream at me, and you know the emptiness thing about my boss screaming. But he would come in and scream at me, and he'd say, you made a really bad decision to send them that thing they asked for. And I'd say, yeah, but at the time it was the right decision based on what I knew. You were out of town. You know, they asked me for that. I bought it for them. I shipped it to them. And he said, it was the right decision at the time, but it didn't work out, so it was stupid and it was wrong. And I said, no. It was right at the time, so it's a right decision, you know. And that's the difference between valid and correct, if you think about it, okay? Valid perception means, given the information I had, it was the best decision I could have made. It turned out to be wrong, okay? And that's the difference between a valid perception and a correct perception. Tsema is really the study of a valid perception. Based on what you know, this perception is valid. Okay. Is it right? That's another question. Okay. That's another question. My argument to my boss was valid is right. He said no. What makes money is right. All right. Okay. Namdel means commentary. Okay. And Master Dhammakirti's famous book is called A Commentary on Valid Perception. Okay. Valid perception here is a code word for Dignaga's original work. Okay. So it's a commentary on the presentation of valid perception according to Dignaga. Okay. But it's written by Dhammakirti. Okay. It's important to know what book you're studying. I've told the story, if you ever meet some great Tibetan Lama and they ask you, what are you studying on Tuesday nights? And it's very embarrassing not to know what you're studying or to give the wrong name. Okay, so it's very useful to know it. Okay, this happened to me with his Dalai Lama's teacher, His Holiness's teacher. And I didn't know the name of the book. And my teacher was sitting there with me and he was very embarrassed. I don't want that to happen to me. Okay, so that's on your homework. You're studying the basic Indian text, you're studying Dhammakirti, written 1300 years ago. The commentary on valid perception. Okay, in Tibet, if you want to know the Sanskrit, it's Pramana Vartika. Okay, Pramana Vartika. Okay, you could read that book for the rest of your life. You would never understand one line of it, trust me. Okay, you need a commentary. Luckily, we have these great Tibetan commentaries. All right, and you're going to be studying the one called Riglam Trukidemik. By the way, if you're new, all you have to know is the English. Okay, we'll torture you with the Tibetan later. By the way, if you're just starting out, you can catch Venerable Puntok's got a good class going on Friday night about how to learn Tibetan, and we have a good video series about how to pronounce the alphabet and stuff like that. So you can try either one of those or both. Okay. But you might have to sit and copy the tapes yourself. Okay. Say Riglam.
Riglam.
Tulki.
Tulki.
Dimik.
Riglam,
Tulki,
Dumi.
Okay, Rig means reasoning or logic. Okay, Rig. Okay, Rig means reasoning, the science or the art of reasoning. Lam means a path. Okay, the path of reasoning. Tool means a machine. Okay, tool is the Tibetan word back in 1900 for a machine. Okay, Tukor. Dumik, which in modern Tibetan is called Demik, means key or starting key. So you're going to study a book called The Key for Starting the Logic Machine. Okay? The Key for Starting the Logic Machine. Okay? Who wrote it? His name is Purbuchok Jampa Tsuchim Gyatso. Okay? He was from Purbuchok. I don't know where Purbuchok is. Like Idaho or something, okay? We just call him Purbuchok. So if you're lazy on your homework, you can probably get away with Purbuchok, all right? This is a very, very relatively recent Tibetan commentary. It's an explanation of the art of reasoning, okay? Without which you would be lost. If you try to study, we've memorized parts of Dhammakirti's work in the monastery, and they're totally obscure. You need a commentary, okay? Gyaltsep J, you can spend 1 month debating one page of Gyaltsep J's commentary. It's not appropriate for this class. In the winter debates, we often spend 4 or 5 days on one page of a 400-page text. It takes 15 years to get through it. Nobody reaches the third chapter. There's 4 chapters. Okay. The one guy who knew how to read it passed away in Tibet last year. Yeshe Wangchu. Geshe Yeshe Wangchu. Okay. Pribhuja Jampa Tsuchim Gyatso was also known as Yongzin. Yongzin means the tutor, capital T, meaning he was the teacher of the Dalai Lama. Okay, he had the position of being the teacher of the 13th Dalai Lama, the last Dalai Lama. And his dates are 1825 to 1901. This is the standard textbook used in modern Tibetan monasteries, okay? Especially Sera. I believe Sera J and Sera May both use the same book, which is unusual since they're so retarded. But, just kidding. I'm getting you ready for the debate style, okay? All right? Just kidding, okay? You're not supposed to do that, except when you're debating, okay? And it's all in good humor. It's like Yale and Princeton thing, okay? And he was a very great master and teacher of the Dalai Lama. Normally, the person who gets to be the teacher of the Dalai Lama is the smartest dude in Tibet at the time, okay? And he was a great writer. I'm going to give you one little more piece, and then we'll take a break. We'll take a break after that. Why study logic, okay? I have like half an hour to sell you on the idea of staying in this class. You know, I was expecting the dropout rate for this class to exceed the last one, but nobody left the last one anyway. We'll see, okay? By the way, it's going to be a lot of fun, and don't worry about it. You can do it, okay? It's really, really fun. By the way, Gyaltsev Jay said that the kindest thing that Jetsun Kapa ever did for him was to teach him this subject. You know, Majjhimika, Tantra, everything else. He didn't say anything. He said the kindest thing that he ever did for me was to teach me about logic. Why? Because this is the key to seeing emptiness. Okay? If you learn logic well, you can see emptiness directly. You can be ready by studying Lam Rim, meditating, etc., Guru Yoga, helping your teacher, helping the Dharma, etc., etc., etc. And then if you study these subjects that you're about to hear, it triggers the direct perception of emptiness. If you're ready for it, these subjects are very famous for triggering that in people's minds. You know, it just goes off. You wouldn't expect it. You know, you'd think logic would be the last thing. But there's something about, especially the study of mental images, which is essential for understanding emptiness. So that's my first sales pitch, okay? It has occurred that by studying these subjects, people see emptiness directly, okay? Especially Chi Che Dak, especially the teaching on mental images, which is an important part of the study of logic, okay? So that's the first reason to study logic. Secondly, and I'm going to put up a quotation by the Sakya Pandita, okay, the greatest master of the Sakya teachings that ever lived. There are two kinds of people who study Buddhism. And Maitreya also mentions this in his text that I spoke about. Okay, there are two kinds of students of Buddhism. This is on your homework. Okay. Here's the first kind. By the way, I'm sorry it's uncomfortable, and I'm sorry my head's in the way. But I think by next week we get to go to the higher realms. But not the next one, I hope. No? Oh. Sooner or later we get to go to the higher realms, okay? It'll be more often than a blind turtle. Say, Ongtu. Tepe. Jendang. Ongtu. Tepe. Jendang. There's this big debate in the monastery about the perfection of wisdom. Who did Maitreya have in mind when he taught the Abhisamma Ankara, you know. Two kinds of people. Was it type A or type B? Okay, what's type A? Type A is Wang Tu Depe Jendang. Wang, if you know the word for tantric initiation, is means power. Okay, Wang means power. Okay. Tupo means dull, like a dull knife. Okay? Tupo means dull. Stupid head. Okay? Wang Tu. You want a good word to use for your debating opponent? There's a good one, Wang Tu. Okay. Depa means faith. Okay? Depa means faith. Depa means faith. Okay? Jendang means to follow somebody or to follow Buddhism. Okay? So what this expression is saying, and this comes from Maitreya, okay, the future Buddha. And it, according, well, can't talk about it. Anyway, this is from the future Buddha, all right? He says, people who follow Buddhism out of blind faith are stupid heads. And that's the first kind of student there is, okay? They follow Buddhism because they like the guy who's standing up there. He looks nice, saying nice things. Who cares if it makes sense or not? He's such a nice guy, you know. And he looks nice. And he's got those red robes on. It must be what he's saying is okay, you know. Even if the next guy for next week says the opposite, okay. And this is considered to be the lousy way of following Buddhism, okay. You don't want to be a Wang Nun, okay, who follows blindly whatever somebody says, okay. You see all these advertisements, you know. So-and-so Lama, close friend to the Dalai Lama. There's so many close friends to the Dalai Lama, I'm not sure how they get time. But he's going to teach next week, you know, come, you know. And then people go, and I, you know, I met one time. I was like, you know, where did you study? He says, well, I'll tell you the truth, I didn't study, you know. And I said, well, what monastery do you belong to? Well, this is on the phone, right? Tell you the truth, I'm not a monk. And you're giving all these initiations and stuff. He said, yeah, you know. And he said, okay. You know, so I went home and I said to Rinpoche, you know, this is crazy. This guy's claiming to be the highest lama in such and such an area. And he isn't even a monk and he never studied anywhere, you know. And people are running to his initiation. They never, because they heard he's a friend of the Dalai Lama. And he said, well, everything he said is true. He is a great lama. He's not a monk. He didn't study. And he's the incarnation of Jetsun Damba from Mongolia. And you better shut up and not judge people. Okay. Okay. All right. Anyway. to run after a lama just because you heard something, it's not good. Okay. I mean, you have to evaluate what the person is saying. You should not follow what people say out of faith. Faith is lousy. Faith breaks down. Faith changes its mind next week. You know what I mean? If it makes sense to you, you should follow it. If it doesn't make sense to you, you should reject it. Period. Okay? Depe Jendang is not the preferred method. It should be logical. It should make sense. Okay? That brings us to the second type of person. Say, Wang Nun. Rikpe Jendang. Wang Nun Rikpe Jendang. Wang again means power, which means mental capacity. It's explained two ways in scripture. One is IQ. Okay? One is IQ. One is spiritual smarts. I don't think we have a word for it in English. Okay? It's a spiritual IQ. So Wang can mean spiritual IQ and intellectual IQ. Okay? Like if you've done a lot of good deeds in your life, you'll have a high spiritual IQ. You may not be the smartest person around in a conventional sense, but you have Wang. Okay, you have power, mental power. Okay, Nun means sharp, very sharp. Rupa you had in that book name means logic, reasoning. Okay, reasoning. Jindang means they follow that. They don't go after faith. They don't run after somebody because they look nice or they have a nice suit on or they speak nicely. Okay? They say to themselves, if what this guy makes sense, says makes sense, I'll do it. And if what he says doesn't make sense, I won't come back. You know, and that's considered the highest intellect in Buddhism. And that's called a person of sharp powers. And you're supposed to be like that. Maitreya said, I didn't write my book for those wangtus. I wrote my book for wangnuns. If you want to study my book, you better be a bodhisattva who's a wangnun. Okay? Meaning, you don't accept what I say unless it makes sense. Okay? Don't accept what I say unless it makes sense. And I'll show you a quotation after the break. In fact, I'll put it up during the break and you can copy it. It's by the Sakyapandita, who lived around, I got his dates on there, it's around 1200, okay? One of the greatest scholars who ever lived in Tibet, and really the person who founded the Sakya tradition as we know it, okay? Great logician and a great translator from Sanskrit. He memorized the 8,000 verses in Sanskrit, Prajnaparamita. He used to recite it going down the road, okay? He says the second reason to study logic, what was the first reason? It really helps you see emptiness. It's a big shot in the arm to see emptiness. Trust me. Okay. Number two, he said, if you think about the survival of Buddhism in this world, which is Tenzin, okay, the Tibetan word Tenzin, whose name is that? Like His Holiness, okay? It's called Tenzin. Tenzin means keeping the Dharma safe in the world. Okay? Keeping the Dharma safe in the world. That it shouldn't get lost. Okay? The Sakyapandita has a very famous quotation from his logic text, which says, the only people who are qualified to keep Buddhism safe in this world are people who understand logic clearly. Okay? People who understand how to do logic. And this is his quotation. You don't have to write it now. We'll write it during the break, okay? You thought you were going to get some refreshments. Detta means like that. Drup means how to prove something. Dung means and. Sun Jin means destroying your opponent, okay? Disproving something. Okay. You can write the Tibetan later, okay? Just get the pronunciation, alright? Rigpa means logic. Shungluk means the books that teach logic, okay? The great books that teach logic. Shungluk. Kangi She means anyone who understands that, okay? Kangi means anyone, and She means understands. Anyone who understands the great books that teach you logic of how to prove things and how to disprove things, okay? That person is a Kepa. Kepa means wise man, Buddhist master, okay? Kepa means a Buddhist master. Deni means that guy, okay? That guy is a Buddhist master, all right? Deni. Dzogpa means totally enlightened, okay? Dzogpa means totally enlightened. Dzogpa Yi goes together, totally enlightened, okay? Sangye means?
Buddha.
Buddha, okay? Buddha, Sangye is Buddha. Kini means of. Tenpa Zin means Tenzin. It's a long form of Tenzin. What's that mean? Somebody who keeps Buddhism in this world safely, okay? A protector of the teachings, a keeper of the teachings, a keeper of the Dharma. So what he's saying is, the second reason to study Buddhism, Buddhist logic, is that if you get good at it, you will really be a person who can keep the Dharma safe in the world. The implication is, if you don't study Buddhist logic, If you don't know how to reason out what's correct explanation of emptiness, for example, and what's not a correct what's an explanation of emptiness that doesn't make sense, if you can't tell the difference, if you can't think about it, you're corrupting the Buddhist teachings in the world. You're destroying the Dharma in the world. Okay? You have to learn how to think clearly. You have to learn how to prove something. If you can't prove what you know to yourself, then Buddhism will get corrupted in this world and it will be destroyed. There may be Buddhist books around. There may be Buddhist teachers around. They may be writing very beautiful, flowery books about Buddhism, and Buddhism will be lost. Okay? We need people who follow reason. We need people who can understand why they believe something. Okay? If it doesn't make sense to you, you should drop it. Okay? If it does make sense to you, you should drop the other stuff and follow this. Okay? And what he's saying is, if you learn how to prove something or how to disprove something, then we consider you safe. You know, we consider you someone who can keep Buddhism safely in the world. And we don't want other kinds of people. Even if they speak nicely and look nice and wear nice robes or whatever, you know. We want people who speak truth and who can prove it in their own minds. Okay? And that's, you must study logic. So, two reasons to study logic so far. First one, it's a big jump start for seeing emptiness. It really is. Believe me. Second one, you can't really be a good Buddhist unless you learn how to think clearly and prove things to yourself. Okay? And you have to study how to do that. And if we want Buddhism to stay pure in this world, which means it still works, okay? Right? It won't work if it gets corrupted. You see what I mean? If it gets corrupted bad enough, it won't work anymore. It has to be kept clean. Which means a good Buddhist shouldn't believe anything until it makes sense to them, until they can prove it in their own mind. And that's the second reason. By the way, it doesn't mean like some dogma or something like that. It means if you corrupt Buddhism to a certain point, it won't work anymore. You know, work to do what? Oh, stop your death and suffering. How's that? You know what I mean? Stop every negative event that ever happens to you. And stop your own death. Okay? That's the promise of Buddhism. That's the goal. Four Noble Truths. One is to stop suffering. That's the goal of Buddhism. Never to have a lousy thing ever happen to you, including your own death. Okay? This is the goal. And at a certain point, if Buddhism gets passed down sloppily, without thinking about it, it will lose that ability. You know, at some point, somebody will teach it so wrong that it doesn't work anymore. For example, if you teach emptiness wrong in the ways that I mentioned, they don't work. You know, it won't work anymore. If you want to kill Buddhism in this world, teach somebody emptiness the wrong way. And within a generation, nobody will be able to achieve anything. You see what I mean? So it depends on logic. You have to study logic. We have one more reason to study logic, and we'll do that after the break. So please come back in about 10 minutes, okay? 10 to 9 we'll start. All right. One question.
Yeah. You said that you have to study logic and specifically see emptiness. Can you see emptiness without studying those?
He said, can you see emptiness without studying logic and without studying Shijedak, which is one of the subjects you're going to study. You cannot see emptiness directly if you don't know the content of Shijedak. Okay, which probably means you studied it in some life, you know. But without knowing the content of it, impossible. Okay.
Some people still like to hear in the back.
Yeah. Okay, we'll start again. Last reason to study logic, okay? And this is very famous. This comes from the scriptures. The first thing that every kid in the debate ground learns is, okay? Very first thing that we ever learn in the debate ground. I'll put it up for you. This is the last long thing, okay? So have hope. I'll give you a minute to copy it. Okay, this is the last and maybe the most important reason for studying Buddhist logic. And this is a very, very famous quotation. Kids in the monastery start memorizing at age 7. This is one of the first things you ever have to memorize. Say Nga Am, Nga Dang, Jawe, Kang Saki, Su, Sunki, Kazaki, Kazaki, Su, Misungte, Nyambak Jetarai. Okay. Right. This is a scriptural proof for a classic kind of logical reason. The logical reason is called Minowa Manipetak, which means trying to prove something that you can't normally see. Okay? Trying to prove something that you can't normally see. An example would be like a hell realm. You know, do you believe in hell? Are you sure that hell exists or doesn't exist? I mean, I think that basically anyone in this room who says, I'm sure it does, I'm sure it doesn't, is being illogical. Okay? You're not sure. Okay? You haven't seen it. Or you haven't seen that it doesn't exist. Okay? I mean, a good Buddhist at our level should say, I don't know, Buddha talked about it, His Holiness talked about it, Ken Rinpoche talks about it, but I'm not sure. I think it's probably true, but to be honest, you know, if I'm really logical, I have to say, I'm not sure. Okay? And that's an example of this kind of reasoning. Okay? And this is the scriptural source that's always used to describe this kind of reasoning. Okay? First I'll go through the quotation, and then I'll talk about the context, okay? Nga. Nga means me. Me. Okay, nga. Nga an means me or, okay? Me or. Nga dang dawa means somebody like me. Okay? So that first part means me or somebody like me. Me or somebody like me. By the way, who's speaking here? The Buddha. Okay, this is a direct quotation from the Buddha. Okay? And the first thing he says is, if you are me, meaning an enlightened being, who sees every object in the universe in one instant, or if you are like me, meaning some other Buddha, Kangsak means other people. Sursung means you can judge them. You can judge them. So the first part here, oh, by the way, the key at the end means, but, all right, but, you know what's coming, right? But, okay, so far what we have is, the Buddha is saying, if you're me, or someone like me, then go ahead and judge other people, from their appearances, okay? Key, but, okay? Kasa ki means other people, who are not like me. Kazaki, people other than them. To misum. Okay, misum means don't judge. Okay, so that second part means, but normal people shouldn't try to judge other normal people. Okay. If you're me or somebody like me, who can read other people's minds directly, you can judge them. Otherwise, normal people shouldn't try to judge other normal people. Why? Why not? Nyambak Jetare. It's very famous in the debate ground, you know. Nyambak Jetare. Okay? Nyambak Jetare means you're going to get in trouble. Okay? Okay? Nyambak means you're going to fail. Jetare means you're gonna. Okay, you're gonna fail. You will get in trouble. You will get in hot water. Okay. And we memorize that over and over again. When you're first studying logic, when you first get to the debate ground, they drill it into you. And you do it over and over again. You see these kids like standing next to a wall, you know, and doing it over and over again, you know. And they have no idea what it's talking about, really. I mean, this is the Buddha, and that's all you ever learn. It's to prove that, logically speaking, if you're going to be logical, you have to be very careful about judging other people, because you cannot see what's in their mind. You see what I mean? You have to be very careful about judging other people. Okay, and here you have to, there's a tachepa. Tachepa means you have to draw some distinctions here. Okay, if you see another person beating up another person, you can judge them to the extent that you should try to stop it. Okay, obviously, you know, it's not, doesn't mean you should stand there and say, oh, Buddha said don't judge anybody. Go ahead, mug this guy, you know. Who knows, you might be a bodhisattva. Who am I to stop you? You know, don't be like that, okay? It doesn't mean that. It means it's your duty as a Buddhist and a bodhisattva to try to stop anyone hurting another person. You must try to stop them. But at the same time, you have to reserve judgment, okay, about their motives and about their state of mind. You don't know. And the better you get at logic, the better you will get at knowing who knows who the people around you are. Okay? You could make huge mistakes, and people have. Okay? You can judge their actions and say, killing is not good, mugging is not good, I have to stop you, I have to try to stop you. But by the way, please excuse me if you're a bodhisattva and you're doing something special that's going to take effect 100 years from now, I don't know. But based on what I know, valid perception, this action is wrong and I have to stop you. But I don't judge you as a person. You know, I don't know. I don't know who you are. And lots of great yogis do lots of strange things. You know what I mean? It means don't judge other people as people. Judge their actions of whether they're correct or not and whether you should resist them or not. And if they're hurting someone, you should resist them. But you have to keep in your mind some logically, you have to keep something reserved in your mind that, I don't know, maybe something special is going on here. You know what I mean? Maybe this person is somebody special. I don't have any idea. You know, logically, strictly logically speaking, you have to reserve judgment from other people. Unless you are Ngada Ngandala. You know, unless you're like, can read the other person's mind. And by the way, you will reach a point where you can. Then you can judge them, okay? You don't have to be enlightened to read people's minds. You can do it, but until that time, you can't judge them. Something very cool happened. I looked for this quotation in the Kangyur and the Tengyur. I surfed the database. We have this database. I found it. It's only there once. It would take you years to find it if you went through the pages. The whole story exists in a very beautiful book by Lord Atisha. Okay, by Atisha. And he collected all these neat stories from the sutras that existed in his day. I don't even know if this sutra exists now, but in his day, the sutra was available. And there's a long, beautiful story. And so I translated the whole thing and stuck it in your reading. Okay? It's really beautiful. And they don't teach it to us in the monastery. I'm not sure if anyone knows about it. Okay? And it's in the time of a former Buddha, like zillions of years ago. And he passes away. And he assigns this monk to keep his teachings in the world. And then there's another monk who's a very, very good monk, a very strict morality, very good meditator. And the second monk opens a monastery, a small monastery. And he calls all his friends, and they get very good at Vinaya, at keeping the monks disciplined. And they get very good at meditating. And they're following what we would call a classic Hinayana lifestyle. They are staying quietly. They don't do a lot of things. They meditate a lot. They keep their monks' things to the letter of the monks' vows. And they are making nice progress like that. Then this other guy shows up, the one that the Buddha had appointed, right? And he moves into the monastery with a couple of his followers. And some people from the nearby town start asking him if he could come over and teach, like come over, have lunch with us, and then if you could stay and teach us something about Buddhism. So out of compassion, he agrees to go. And he starts to visit the town more and more. And then most nights or most days he's gone, teaching the common people Buddhism, teaching it to lay people, and trying to help them because of his bodhisattva motivation. The first monk gets starts to judge him. He starts to doubt his motivation. And he starts to spread rumors that this monk is doing something strange or something improper in town. And he shouldn't be going to town and teaching the lay people. He should stay in the monastery with us and meditate and concentrate on these things here. And the Buddha said that we should do that. And here's this monk going off to town every day, and we don't know what he's doing, and we don't know where he's going. And he says he's teaching people, but we don't know. And he starts to spread rumors about monk number two. Okay. Eventually, the monk's mission in the city becomes so successful that he and all his followers are going every day to the city to teach all the people. And it's this great movement is opening up and starting to form in the town among normal people. And so for the first time, the lay people are understanding Buddhism and everyone is happy and the monks are going every day. And the other monk is getting more and more jealous and more upset. And then finally, he calls a big meeting of the monks and he says, this is really bad. You know, all these monks are embarrassing us. They're going out in the town. They spend their time with lay people. We hereby make a rule in this monastery that no one can go to town. And so for 3 months, the other monk, out of consideration, follows the rules. Meanwhile, the people in the town are getting upset at all the monks. And they're saying, this is terrible. You know, the monks aren't coming anymore. It's all because of this misunderstanding. And now it's hurting us, you know, and they're all upset. So eventually the second monk moves out, starts a new monastery, starts to teach in one city, it spreads to another city, it spreads to another city, spreads out of state, spreads to several states, then the whole country is practicing this thing. And eventually the whole country is being taught ways of getting enlightened. Okay, the other monk is going crazy with jealousy, right? And not happy at all about it. The other monk eventually died. And then the story is that you can read, it's like 10 billion periods of 10 million years or something. He was born in the lowest hell. After that, he became a monk in a certain Buddha's lifetime, but he lost his robes in every lifetime. And these horrible results for millions of years from slandering the other monk. Then the Buddha says, Nan lan dawe, kazaki tsu sunki, kazaki tsu sun misunte, nyamar gyotare. That is where this quotation comes from. He says, you can't judge other people. You have to be very, very careful about other people's motivations. You don't know who's a bodhisattva. You don't know who's a tantric deity. And that is the goal of logic. You know, this is what we learn. This is the most important lesson of Buddhist logic. You don't know who the people around you are. Concentrate on your own practice. And then the Buddha says, look, go home. Don't look around you. Concentrate. You know your own mental afflictions. You know you're not enlightened. If you're not, okay? And you know you have to work on your own mind. Don't worry about other people's practice. It's enough trouble to keep your own straight. You know, don't worry about judging other people's Buddhist practice. You know, work on your own. And this is the justification that they give for studying logic. Because if you study long enough logic, you can prove to yourself that you don't know who the people around you are. You really don't know. Does that mean you shouldn't judge their actions? Of course not. You must judge their actions. You don't join a bunch of muggers because you don't want to judge them. Okay? It's not like that. Here's the punchline, okay? Which they never teach you in the monastery. Lord Buddha says, you think that good monk in those days was just anybody? Hey, that was Buddha so-and-so who became enlightened just after that. You know, the bodhisattva who went out among the people. And you think the guy that went to hell for millions of years, you think the guy that lost his robes for millions of years was just anybody? Well, I got news. It was me. Okay? And it's very, you know, you read it in the scripture and you're like, you know, it's like, wow. And he's describing the time he spent in hell. for judging other people, you know, as a result, the karma of judging other people. And it just makes your spine tingle, you know. The last lines of the sutra are, you know, that was me, okay, and in my former life, you know, I made that mistake, don't make that mistake. And they never teach you that in the monastery, so I thought you'd like to have the whole story. And it's in your reading. Okay, last few minutes. I don't know if you have anything else. Oh. I'm sorry. I'm going to give you the first little bit of formal logic. It's a 30-second video clip, okay? That's all you have the attention span for left, or maybe less, okay? I'll just give it to you in a minute. Say, Taksukupa. Takitini. Taksukupa. Takitini. Okay? What is the definition of a reason in Buddhism? This is the central and the first question that you have to ask as a Buddhist, you know? How do you define that thing called a reason? Okay? Tak means reason, all right? Tak. Tak. Takitini means that's the definition of a reason. Okay? Takitini means here's the definition of a reason. Okay? What is it? Taksukupa. Okay, say Taksukupa. Taksukupa. Very interesting. Anything I give you as a reason. There it is. Okay. It'll be easy to be a reasonable Buddhist, right? That's your last thing tonight, okay? The tak means reason, okay? Tak means reason. Taksu means as a reason. Taksu means as a reason. Kupa means to put forth something. When you set out your water bowls in the morning, those of you who do, that's called kupa. Okay, it means to arrange things. Taksu kupa means to give somebody a reason. Okay. Tak means the tak down here means reason again. Takitseni means the definition of a reason. So taksu kupa takitseni means the definition of a reason. Is anything I want to give you as a reason. Okay. So how's this one? It's right to study Buddhism because the sky is green. Okay? It's right to study Buddhism because the sky is green. Okay? Nanbe chachia de jikwe yinte or namga de jangu yinte cha. Okay? It's right to study Buddhism because the sky is green. Is the green sky a reason? Yeah, why? Because I gave it to you as a reason, okay? It fits the definition. I didn't say anything about good reason, did I? Okay. So the first thing you do in Buddhist logic, you study the definition of a reason. We'll get to good reasons later, okay? And then we'll get to bad reasons, okay? But the basic shtick is that you begin your all your... What's the first thing you debate? What's the first thing in the logic book? You know, that quotation. After you get past that, they say, hey, here's the definition of a reason. Anything you want to say is a reason. Okay? And if you think about it, that's what a reason is. Okay? Taksu kupa takitini. Yume kanu yina, say yume.
Yume.
Kanu yina.
Tak.
Yibi kyop. Okay? Doesn't matter whether it exists or not. Everything in the universe is a reason. You can use anything as a reason. Okay? It doesn't even have to exist. Okay? It's right to study Buddhism because rabbits have 12-inch horns. Okay? Very famous in the monastery. Okay? All right? That's the first thing. That's the first definition you have to understand. Okay? Taksu kupa takitini. Very important. And that's enough. That's a demdel. That's an auspicious beginning to your logic study. And you have to memorize that. Okay? In the English or the Tibetan. The English is in your reading. Okay? Taksu kupa takitini. We're going to hand out rosaries now. We got about 6 minutes to talk about debating. I'm not going to start tonight. We'll do a little bit next week. I wanted to give you a little bit of background about what it feels like to debate. So you can start handing out those rosaries. We're going to give everybody a rosary. They've been sponsored by the rabbit's horns credit card. And they're just an offering to everybody, okay? Do you have a rosary? Anybody have a rosary? Okay. I mean, the way you debate, we'll go through it, okay? I'm not going to do it tonight. I'm not. But rosaries are very important. If you look in the temple at Leon, there's a guy like that, you know. And that's Dharmakirti, okay? Or Dignaga. There's both of them there, But rosaries have been used since ancient India, okay? Every debater has to have a rosary. So you're going to get one tonight. Don't lose it, okay? You wear it on your left wrist. You know, you can tell a guy who's faking it as a debater if he's got it on the wrong arm. You know? That's, by the way, this is why His Holiness always wears. I mean, that's a sign in the monastery. You walk around with that, it means I'm a gunslinger. Okay? And they never take them off. I mean, the good debaters are, you know, it's like a statement. You know, you want to debate with me? You know. I got it. Yeah. What's that?
Is it?
Yeah, it's good. Okay. I mean, it's where a debater uses it. Because most people clap with their right hand. Okay, most people. But it's very useful, okay? It's very common to ask the guy to count. Oh, count for me the seven parts of the Arya path. Okay, come on, come on, come on. One, two, and you'll count it with him. You see what I mean? If he's getting sleepy, there's a disciplinarian and the assistant disciplinarian, who's usually your classmate, which is very bad. And they're allowed to whack people who are sleeping or being lazy, okay? And you see guys come back from the debate ground with these dots across their head. It's very embarrassing. It happened to me once. But you come back home with this dot across your head. But this is commonly used in a debate. That's your only weapon in a debate, okay? They play a gong from the top of the temple, the main temple. You can hear it for about a mile. It's called a kanga. Say kanga. Kanga means sky drum, and it's a name for this huge gong. And then one of the guys gets up there, you know, and goes boom, you know. And the first time you hear it, you get this, the adrenaline starts to go, you know. And they start ringing it about 15 minutes before debate starts. And then they start speeding up. You see, they'll go gong, and then they'll wait for a minute. And then they'll hit it again. And then they'll hit it every half a minute. And then they'll hit it every quarter of a minute. And then it'll start going dong, 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 dong. And then you've got to be sitting there in the debate ground. If you show up late, you get this. I had a debate master use an electric horn. But these are better. These don't hurt as much. And you got to be sitting down in the debate ground. You're not allowed to take a scrap of paper. You must do everything from memory. You know, everything must be in your mind. Everything has to be ready in your mind. I remember debates we had where the lights went out and you don't even hesitate. You just keep going. You can't see the other guy. And you just keep going. You're supposed to keep going. We had a defense one night and I was up there, you know, and the lights all went out. And I said, the powerful American debater has made the lights go out. Now answer the question. you know, you learn to use things to taunt your opponent. It's like but it doesn't matter, you see, because everything has to be in your mind. You've memorized everything. And your arguments are, it's beautiful, because later when you need, especially in America, it's going to be your job to teach Buddhism to other people. There's not going to be any more challenging of Buddhism than is going to happen in America in the next 10 years. You see, Buddhism as a belief system, as a worldview, it'll be challenged in this country in the next 10 years. Buddhism is going to take off. It is taking off. I mean, we send out 12,000 tapes so far without any it's just word of mouth, you know. And then thousands and thousands of people are going to be studying it, and it will be questioned. You know, people will question it, and you have to be ready to answer. That's the thing about debate. Gives you the experience of being questioned constantly. And then when you have to teach other people, you'll have answers ready because you went through it before. You're good at it already. So you go to the debate ground. All you get is a little Tibetan carpet about this size, and you set it down, and you sit there. And it's cold, okay? I mean, at night. And in my day, there was no electricity. And we would just be debating under the stars. You debate outside in a park, and it's really, really nice at night. And you might go till 3 in the morning. Sembe Damcha, all night. You debate all day and all night, 24-hour debate, in the winter debates. And it's just beautiful. It's like being at a football game or a rock concert, I don't know. But anyway, it's really exciting, and it's going on for the whole day and the whole night. And you sit there, but the first thing you do when you get there is a thing called kurim. Say kurim.
Kurim.
Kurim. By the way, don't lose your rosary. If you come next time without it, you'll get one. if you didn't sign your name, please raise your hand. Okay. Okay, say kurim.
Kurim.
Kurim. I want to talk a little bit, we have like 1 minute, about the motivation for debating, you know. And the first thing you do when you get to the debate ground, they close the gate. And the new debate ground, which I designed, with Rinpoche's instructions, is 8 feet high. The wall is 8 feet high. It means you can't get out and nobody can see you, you know. They close the gates. And then you're in, and you sit down in this huge circle, maybe 300 debaters. In the winter debates, there'll be 1,000 or 1,200 debaters. And you start the kurim. Kurim is prayers before you debate. And you will spend, on a typical night, a half an hour to 45 minutes just praying to all these wonderful angels, tantric angels, that you have the right motivation for the debate. That you're not debating for competitiveness. You're not debating to show off. You will come to the debate ground and you will explore reality with your friends. You see? And this is so cool. You know, you will explore truth with your friends. And you will get to the bottom of truth with your friends. Why? Because then you'll be qualified to, it'll get you enlightened faster. You see, you'll see emptiness much faster. You can help other people. You know, a typical person, you and me, how many hours in a day, you know, how many people can you teach? How many people can you touch? How many people can you talk to? How many phone calls can you take? You know, you quickly reach your limit. I know. Okay, you quickly reach a limit. You can't help more people than that. I mean, there becomes a logistical, physical limit. You can't be on the phone more than that. You can't sleep less than that. You know, this is our condition. If you debated, quickly speeds up your perception of emptiness, direct perception of emptiness. And quickly after that, you can reach a different kind of body. You know, a Buddha's body. Remember the quality of a Buddha. The Buddha, quality of a Buddha, you can sit here in the Quaker house on your chair and be appearing to every living being in the universe at the same time. Period. And you can help them directly because you can read their minds. And you can help them everything they need automatically. Okay, this is the quality of a Buddha. Okay, the reason to do all the wimpy little helping that you and me do now is that it causes that other thing, okay? And that has to be your motivation for debating, okay? I know the word logic and the word debating, it sounds a little scary, you know? I hated logic in college, you know? I purposely got out of that class, okay? Because it was so boring and so stupid, you know? I did, okay? And it is, okay, if you do it that way. The purpose of Buddhist logic is totally different. if you learn Buddhism well, if you see emptiness directly, you can get very close to a state where you don't have to die. And you can understand why all the bad things happen in the world, and you can stop them for yourself. You see what I mean? I can't stop them for you. Okay? I mean, I can, if I practice Buddhism very, very well, I can, in this life, enter another reality. You would still see me. And I would still look like a normal old guy. Okay? What I'm seeing is totally different. Okay? I mean, if you think His Holiness is like a 60-year-old guy who's getting arthritis in his back and he's balding and stuff like that, forget it. If he doesn't look that way to himself. You see what I mean? What does the Dalai Lama see when he looks in the mirror? You have no idea. Kawasaki, Susumi Jate Nyambagyotare. Okay? You have no idea what he sees. I have a feeling it's something much different. Okay? Really. Honestly. Okay? And that could happen to anyone here. And you wouldn't look much different to us. You see? But what you're seeing about yourself would be totally different. What I'm saying is that I claim, right? It's not logical, okay? I claim that if you study this stuff well and you debate it well, you can become a tantric deity in this lifetime. Okay? No problem. You can do it. Okay? The instructions are all there. It depends on your effort and your learning Buddhism correctly and keeping your book, okay? Frankly, because that's what divides the men from the boys. You know, that's what makes you different than you were before, is watching your behavior and changing it. You can learn all the Buddhism you want. If you don't change your behavior, I promise it won't do anything. Okay? It doesn't. Why would you expect it to do anything, right? But if you learn Buddhism well, you will find out that it's true that a person can stop all the suffering of this life, from the smallest lousy thing on the sidewalk, you know, up to death itself. You can change it. You can avoid it. You can transform it. You know, you really can. That puts a big responsibility on you, especially the people in this room. Okay, you're the first American Buddhist, right? If what I said is true, you have the potential to save people's lives. Okay, if what I said is true, every person in this room is a potential teacher, and to teach other people how to save their lives. I'm not talking meditating calmly in a corner. I'm talking going to a realm where you don't have to die and where you are a different kind of being. You can do that. If that's true, you have a tremendous responsibility. The longer you fool around, the more people are getting hurt. Okay? Every day you lose is many other people getting hurt. You see? And that's the motivation you have to have when you debate. Okay? That's the only reason we're debating. I'm not trying to embarrass you. I'm not trying to make you nervous. You know, it's not some game. It's not some intellectual game or like that. It's not. It's life or death for you and other people. Okay? It really is. It honestly is. The purpose to debate is that it quickly gets you to see emptiness directly. It quickly gets you to your spiritual goals. Much quicker than anything, than any other intellectual way to study Buddhism. I studied in New Jersey for 8 years, every day under Ken Rinpoche. We translated the Abhidhamma Kosha. It took me 8 years. I went to the monastery to debate for 6 months. I came back and threw out everything and started over again. You debate for a few weeks, you will learn this thing. It's just wonderful. There's things that will happen in your mind that cannot happen when you sit and read a book, and they cannot happen if you listen to someone teach Buddhism. You learn to rip it apart, and you learn to figure out what you believe and what you don't believe. And there's no way that's better than debating. So it has to be your motivation, you know. You are saving lives, okay? You have to think like that. I'm not just doing it for fun. And I don't want you... It will be fun. But people's lives are at stake, and I'm not kidding and I'm not exaggerating, okay? If Buddhism is true, that's the stakes. And this is the best way to learn it fast, you know, and it's a lot of fun. Okay, so that's my advertisement for the motivation. And we do kurim in the monastery every Thursday night, you don't debate. You do Kurim for 3 or 4 hours, you know, and you just sit there and think about these things. And that's part of the debate experience. And I want you to remember that. That's my first night's spiel, okay? But don't forget Kurim. And we'll do Kurim, okay? Kurim means you sit there and you think about these things. Why am I doing this, okay? And you never debate without that. There's no debate in any monastery, Gelugpa monastery, that doesn't start with a Kurim. You know, you sit and you think of why. You know, why am I doing this? All right? That's all. I wrote out the whole Kurim. I think it's for the first time it's ever been written down. And Ken Rinpoche helped me and some other lamas helped me. And I was mostly Wawa during the Kurims. Do you know Wawa? Wawa is if the Kurim is 3 hours long and you've only memorized 5 minutes of Ganen Hagyama. You go, but I always try to have the right motivation. Okay, we're going to do Wawa. Okay. All right, so remember Kurim. And there's a description of Kurim in your reading, and I think that's the first time it's ever been written down, the whole thing. It's very, very powerful prayer. In an extensive Kurim, we do the Heart Sutra 18 times in a row. Okay? I mean, and you're thinking about emptiness through 18 Heart Sutras. That's why it's the only thing I memorized that well. Okay. All right. We'll stop there. Okay? We'll do prayers.
This is the end of Class 1.
You have been listening to The Art of Reasoning with Geshe Michael Roach, presented by the Asian Classics Institute.
The Asian Classics Institute is dedicated to preserving the pure teachings and practice of Buddhism. For a listing of other topics available, write to The Asian Classics Institute, P.O. Box 20373, New York, New York, 10009, or call 212-475-7752.